Hello and welcome to the third episode of the Nations of Charlemagne series. Today we're going to be looking at Italy between empires, the fall of Rome, barbarian warlords, Byzantine restoration, and the rise of the papacy. Very lucky as always to be joined by Columba.
Hello everyone.
And by Marcus Furious Bethnax.
Hello everyone.
Now, tonight is going to be, we're going to try and cram a lot in this evening. Just to give you a brief outline of what we're going to do, we're going to be covering the the causes of the collapse of the Western Roman Empire very briefly and how they pertain to Italy especially. So taking us from the Gothic Wars all the way up to the last emperor, Romulus Augustulus. And after that point, we are going to be covering the Kingdom of Odovaca, the Ostrogoths, the Lombards, the restoration of the Byzantine Empire under Belisarius, and the rise of the papacy all the way until the Carolingians begin to encroach on Italy at the beginning of the 8th century. So as to why this is significant, I believe within this 300 or so year period that we're covering, especially after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, you will see all of the political trends emerging which will define Italy for the next 1,000 years. So that this is actually an incredibly pivotal point in Italian history. However, it is also one of the most criminally overlooked periods of Italian history as well. So we'll hopefully remedy that and also try and look at some of the pervasive themes of Romanitas that continue throughout this entire period as well. The title is obviously Italy Between Empires. You know, my controversial opinion is that the Roman Empire did indeed continue in Italy throughout this entire time, albeit under various different forms and completely under a different political system. So I think a great way to start will be by providing, I guess, a quick summary of the overall causes for the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, very, very briefly before we get to the Great Migrations. Would anyone like to start there? Just a quick overview.
Well, Marcus is our military expert, so perhaps he could talk about some of the incursions and wars that the Empire is suffering from in this period.
Okay, sure. I'll just do a brief overview. Most of it's military, some of it is not. And those non-military factors pertain to the currency and the debasing of the currency of the sestertia primarily. The fact that a number of emperors did attempt to address this one issue, but were unable to do so. Most famously, Diocletian with the price controls. But as I mentioned last week, throughout this time, the Roman army has essentially doubled in size, not necessarily with a change of quality, by and large. And this has placed a heavy tax burden upon the Roman state. As well, we are talking about a period where we have the Roman Empire suffered the Antonine Plague, and then there's a plague later on in the life of the Empire, just, I think, prior to Constantine. And, of course, there's a major plague in Justinian's time, which we know about. Also, there's a bit of a socio-demographic question with the mass influx of German tribes into primarily the Western Empire, in the form of the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Suevi, the Alemanni, etc., and the Angles and Saxons in Britannia, a displacing of people. You also have the sort of intermixing of people and central a political and governorial collapse of the Western Roman Empire.
Yes, and so I think just to stop you there. I think we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves in terms of this is again stuff we're going to be covering hopefully more in depth this evening. Yes. But yes, you bring up quite a few crucial points, including the devaluation of the currency. But in terms of sort of bringing this down to like a specific chronology, we're going to start this conversation by talking about Adrianople and the lead up for the Visigoth sacking of Rome in 410. And I think just to summarize that, I'd like to probably understand more as to why those migrations started happening. From my understanding, a lot of it was precipitated by the arrival of the Huns.
Definitely.
For people who don't know, the Huns were, again, it's slightly in dispute as to where the Huns came from, but I think it's more or less understood that the Huns share striking similarities with the Xiongnu in Mongolia, which were the scourge of the Han dynasty in the 3rd century. And it's basically commonly understood that the Huns, or certain branches of the Huns, broke off, and they would become the Huns which we know in history, the Huns which would produce Attila, even though it wasn't just, they weren't just attacking the Romans either, a group of them, the Hephalites, the White Huns, were also attacking the Sasanian Empire at the same time. And I think it's in the 370s that we have the Huns arriving on the Pontic steppe. And I'll just get a map out quickly so people can see, you know, all this geography which I'm discussing here. So here we have a map of Europe, and as you can see, the Pontic steppes is just this area at the beginning of at the bottom of Ukraine, and it pushes a lot of the Gothic peoples across, you know, here of modern day Romania, across the Danube. And they, you could say, they have a very poor reception when they cross over into the province of Mesia. And this sort of leads up to the Battle of Adrianople. Does anyone want to discuss that?
I'm not an expert on the battle. It's more the aftermath, and you have the settling of the Gauls in Pannonia and stuff. Yes, so I couldn't comment.
Marcus?
The Goths have more or less settled, at least sort of semi-permanently, on the Danubian frontier for the better part of a century. Quite infamously, Constantine did cross the Danuban campaign against them more than once, along with campaigns against the Sarmatians, who were neighbors of the Goths at this time, not far from where the Roxolani are on that map. And so that border, although it is penetrated on a number of occasions, the Goths themselves don't sort of pour over en masse. What we have with the arrival of the Huns into the southern portion of this sort of Eurasian steppe, just north of the Crimea here, is this cascading effect that migration has. The Huns basically push the Sarmatians into the Roxolani, and then they sort of crash into the Goths. And you have the two branches of the Goths, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, and they, I think it's along with the Alans, the Alani, who also go across the Danube. And as Apostolic just said, they were treated rather poorly. There's a combination of factors here, a bit of malfeasance, a bit of the traditional late Roman corruption by magistrates and generals, a general shortage of supplies, even from the Roman perspective of supplying their own troops adequately. And of course, Valens at this point is actually campaigning in the east against the Sassanids. So there's actually quite a prolonged, protracted sort of touch and go campaign here in when you can see on that map, just basically with the S's on Visigoths, sort of in that eastern quadrant of what we call Mesia, or what the Byzantines later called Peristrian, where the Goths are sort of bottled up once they do cross the Danube. And the Eastern Empire does resort to some assistance from the West. Gratian does send over at least some initial reinforcements to stabilize his frontier for the Eastern Empire. But there are instances where the Goths themselves are, well, firstly mistreated, we mentioned that, but the, I can't remember who the Roman leader was, invited a Fritigern and the leaders. Yeah. No, huh?
Was it not Aetius who invited the, he was sort of playing the Huns and the Goths off against each other?
That's later. That's much later. That's in the West. I'm just trying to think who the general is. I've just gone blank, sorry. But Fritigern and his co-king are invited to a banquet. The Roman general attempts to assassinate them. He assassinates one. Fritigern escapes. Fritigern manages to rally his group of soldiers. They attack the Romans. They put the Romans to flight just on the outskirts of Marcianopolis, which is, I think it was the capital of Mesia at the time, re-equips themselves with the weapons they pick up from the Roman dead, the arms and armor, and the Goths start to realize that they cannot negotiate with the Romans. The Romans are not negotiating good faith. And you sort of set the climax for the battle that will become the Battle of Adrianople. Sort of once the Eastern armies are sent from Antioch and arrive at the capital and then are sent into Mesia, you have a trickle of reinforcements from the West, which are dispatched by Gratian ahead of the main army, which he commands to lead across to the east from Gaul through Illyria into Mesia. And this sets the stage for the battle itself of Adrianople.
Wonderful, and that's a very conclusive a summary of the events leading forward. Of course, what happens at Adrianople is that the Romans are decisively defeated and the Emperor Valens is himself killed. However, it doesn't lead to like a complete collapse of the Eastern Roman Empire, you know, far from it. In fact, one of the interesting sort of turns of fate is that the Visigoths would actually be later employed by the Emperor Theodosius in reclaiming and uniting the empire in 394 at the Battle of Frigidus, defeating Eugenius. And for people who want to find out more about that, Columba and I did a stream on Julian the Apostate, talking about the overall religious significance of Theodosius defeating Frigidus. Nevertheless, Alaric, who is now king of the Goths, feels mistreated by the Romans. Again, it's a constant theme. And to make matters worse, the last sort of competent emperor of both halves of the empire, Theodosius, dies in 395, leaving two child emperors in both halves of the empire, Honorius in the west and Arcadius in the east. And to, again, emphasize the significance of the barbarian penetration into the Roman Empire at this point, the caretaker for both of the child emperors is a general called Stilicho. And as far as I'm aware, Stilicho was a half-Vandal Roman general.
Yeah, he was. Which Indeed. Is very common, increasingly common, right?
I mean, yes, exactly. And this is going to be a constant theme that we're going to crop up on as we go along, is this duality between the Germanic and Roman aspects of various leaders and the pivotal importance of various Germanic warlords, especially over the next couple of centuries. Alaric, feeling that he wasn't sufficiently compensated for his joining with Theodosius, in addition to many other reasons, begins a pillaging campaign of most of the Balkans. He sacks Athens, I believe, basically a campaign of carnage, and he attacks Italy in 401. To make matters worse, it's not just him. There's also another Gothic king known as Radagaisus, who also invades Italy in 405. He's defeated by Stilicho. The effect of this is that many of the Roman legions have to be pulled back. In fact, it's not even the traditional Roman structure, military structure anymore. It's more just having to rely on federati who will join up with the Roman cause to defend Italy. And the effect of this is in 406, the barbarians are able to cross the Rhine border in droves, and Stilicho is blamed for this. And I believe there is a coup d'etat against the growing influence of Stilicho, who is desperately trying to control both courts at this time, both the Eastern Roman court and the Western Roman court, to basically keep the military pressure on the barbarians from, you know, flooding all across the empire. Nevertheless, there's a coup against him in 408, and I believe he basically succumbs to his own execution in the end, as far as I'm aware.
There's always a fear amongst the emperors, even in the early stages, that a general, having too many successes or having any successes at all, he could become a threat and a potential claimant to the throne. I mean, that goes all the way back to people like Agricola, you know.
Yes, and the sad thing is that, you know, Stilicho is, of course, lionized as, you know, one of the last Romans. But Honorius, even when he grows into a majority, you know, proves to be just as an incompetent emperor as when he was a child. And the effect of this, you know, removing one of the best commanders at this time, leads Rome open to be sacked by Alaric, king of the Visigoths, in 410. Just to put this in significant into context, of course, the Roman Empire doesn't have its capital at Rome anymore. The principal capital is at Constantinople in the east, and the Western Roman capital switches between Mediolanum, which is modern-day Milan, and Ravenna. And so the
and part of this is because Rome is, you know, due to its size and its history, it's not very easy to fortify, right? Whereas Ravenna is more easily defended.
Yes, originally it was Milan because an emperor situated there could quickly rush up to either the Pannonian or the Rhine frontiers. And Ravenna, sorry. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, something worth mentioning too is this is also partially a legacy of the post-Tetrarchy era, where the emperors place an emphasis on having capitals, you're about to mention this, I'm sorry to interrupt, but having capitals closer to the frontier so they could more rapidly respond to crises.
Yes, and I believe the other capital in the west was also, there were four capitals, I believe. There was Trier, Mediolanum, Sirmium, and Nicomedia before they were you know, turned into the modern dual empire under Constantine, but that was under Diocletian. So that's going back a couple of hundred years.
And it's funny, like yes. we could argue in terms of another reason for the fall of the empire and the instability is this is a theme that I've tried to bring up, is that with every sort of corrective shift that you see in the empire, it creates new problems. And the tetrarchy and this division of power and division of commands, they think, oh well, you know, the empire, clearly there are so many problems going on that governance of the empire by one man isn't feasible, we need to split up rule. But of course what ends up happening is that you divide sovereignty, you divide power, and things become far less efficient. There are even more claimants to the throne and things become even more unstable. So I just thought I'd point that out.
Yes, no,
it's a very important point, and this is going to be again a theme we encounter. The fundamental change in how the Romans are able to govern their provinces and even, you know, rely on certain barbarian troops to command their armies. In terms of the overall effect on the Roman Empire as a result of this point, the Visigoths don't stay in Italy. Alaric tries to leave to North Africa. Paradoxically, you know, for us thinking today, Tunisia, which was the province of Africa in addition to eastern parts of Algeria and Libya, were considered the breadbasket of the empire at this point. So it was a natural place to migrate to, you know, if you wanted to ensure food for your tribe.
There's even some evidence that suggests that, in fact, those areas were agriculturally far more productive than they are today, because they had the Romans had very advanced irrigation techniques, and also, of course, political stability that even in this period was probably more stable than today.
Something to consider if you consider the population of the empire at this stage, which wasn't too dissimilar to the population even say around Hadrian's time. Maybe you could knock off a few tens or maybe 100,000 or so, but the empire had been mostly static in terms of mean population over time. That I believe around half of all grain was produced in Egypt, and that the next 25% of cereal production came from North Africa. So if you consider the value of Egypt and North Africa agriculturally in terms of grain production for the Romans, which is A, to feed the army, and of course B, for the corn dole that the Romans famously had, Africa was absolutely vital in this context.
Absolutely. And this will lead wonderfully on to the next part, because, of course, as we mentioned, Visigoth doesn't stay in Italy. He moves into what is now the area around Bordeaux in Gascony in southern France, and they would later move and take over large parts of Spain as well. And this precipitates a general collapse of the Roman frontier. So around the year 418, you mentioned the Alans. The Alans have moved in. The Suevi have moved into the regions around Asturias and Galicia. The Vandals would, obviously, looking at that prospect of taking over North Africa, they would establish their own Vandal kingdom in North Africa and become a major seafaring power at that same time. And also, I think it's important to note that the Franks also cross over, and the Alemanni cross over, and the Burgundians cross over. So moving on from our map here, just to show you the overall situation in the empire. I have a map during the reign of Emperor Majorian. So complete chaos, as you can see.
Oh, wow.
It's worse than the Balkans.
Uber Balkans, that's not good, huh?
In terms of moving on from this again, the Vandals will come and sack Rome in the year 455, operating out of their kingdom in North Africa. And I think it's important to note, we've already mentioned the Emperor Honorius. Honorius, I believe, would die in about 423, you know, being a thoroughly loathed and ineffective emperor. And eventually he'll be replaced by Valentinian III, who would reign from 425 until 455. And the important thing to note is, you know, unlike in the crisis of the third century, where you tend to have an emperor every year, if not more, despite the fact you had long reigning emperors during this point, they were basically, you know, militarily inert. So in the beginnings phase, of course, we have Stilicho controlling Honorius until he's, you know, ultimately betrayed. And in the later phase of Valentinian III, we have Aetius. And I think it's important to mention, I mentioned Majorian. Majorian is probably the last effective emperor of the Western Roman Empire. And as you can see here in this map, he does reconquer large parts of the Roman Empire, almost conquers all of Spain back from the Visigoths, part of southern France. And then he tries to launch a reconquest of North Africa at this point. However, his fleet is all burnt before he can launch this operation. And going back to the significance of barbarian generals and how influential they were in Rome, in the year 461, Majorian comes back having, you know, been humiliated in his attempt to reconquer Africa. And he is murdered and betrayed by his general, his Suevic general Ricimer. Do any of you have anything to say on the background of Ricimer?
Just before we touch on Ricimer, I think Majorian is an emperor that really deserves a bit of how shall I say, praise. And there's a really eloquent quote here by Edward Gibbon I'd like to introduce to the audience, if I may.
Sure, go ahead.
Gibbon says in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, this is how he describes Majorian. He presents the welcome discovery of a great and heroic character, such as sometimes arise in a degenerate age, to vindicate the honor of the human species. I think that small sort of epithet describes not only Majorian the man himself, but the situation in which he finds himself. And even just by looking at that map, you can see the utter chaos he was sort of born into, the calamity of the times. And yet he still rises up and essentially almost pulls off an Aurelian so late in the empire's life. And I think even for me, I only sort of discovered Majorian myself a few years ago through research and reading and whatnot. And I really think that Majorian is sadly an emperor that is much underappreciated historically.
Well, he certainly had a very difficult job. I mean, you mentioned the control by Stilicho of Honorius, and this is a very important thing. And it's something that you see increasing as the empire declines. I mean, Honorius and Arcadius, they're child emperors. And the other child emperor that comes to mind is Elagabalus, you know, back in the Severan dynasty. And in fact, what we often see when there's a child emperor, it represents the increasing power of an influence of separate sort of bureaus, you know, be it the Praetorians or the Exploratores, and these sorts of groups. Or you know, one of the emperor's mothers, or then another senatorial faction, and so you know, a child emperor is more easily manipulated. And this is why we have to have some admiration for any emperor in this period that manages to get anything done, because there are so many power is not centralized like it was in, you know, the early empire. There's so many competing influences and bodies, and the bureaucracy is also pretty stultifying. And so yeah, it's extremely difficult for an emperor to sort of take sweeping action and to have the kind of authority that an emperor would have had in the centuries preceding. So certainly.
Well, also the emperor can't rely on the legions in the same way that he used to. I mean, one of the effects of this overall collapse is that the Roman emperor has to basically be a mediator between various tribes and bring those tribes, the federati, onto his side in order to effectively launch any military campaign. So we also have a complete destruction of the Western Roman Empire and Roman army at the same time. And what the armies that the Western Roman Empire are able to field aren't in any way sort of technologically or even tactically superior to those of the barbarians at this point. You know, they're definitely completely caught up.
Could I ask a question? Sort of, I mean, this, I suppose, pertains to our discussion on Gaul. Looking at this map here and looking at the Visigoths, the kingdom that they took over in southwest France, would that not just correspond almost exactly to Gallia Aquitania? So I wonder, to what extent were these barbarian kingdoms that were set up, did they what's the word I'm looking for, you know, take over and appropriate the existing infrastructure there? And that sort of goes some way to explaining the divisions in territory.
Do you want me to answer that, or Marcus?
Yeah, it's just a thought that occurred to me.
Well, I think in terms of this overall discussion, in terms of being assimilated into certain territory or province, in terms of France, we are going to be covering that when we cover the Magovians and the Franks. Of course, you can see on the map in the north, the Franks have taken over the old Roman provinces of Germania. I believe it's Germania Inferior and Belgica up in the north as well, and as I mentioned, as we mentioned, this is going to be a primarily focused on Italy. And when we get to the old map of the Ostrogothic kingdom, you'll see that it does correspond in many ways to old Roman provinces at the same time. So there is a continuity, and I'll explain that there is a continuity in the constitution, there is a continuity in law, there is even a continuity in certain political institutions like the Senate, and you know, the fact that invariably many of the barbarian generals would hold the rank of magister militum, meaning master of soldiers. So I think in all respects, yes, there is a form of continuity in terms of all these institutions, and the barbarians basically take over an old Roman province and establish it as a new fiefdom that would later become the kingdoms of Europe. But I think, you know, that's more of an overarching point. Marcus, do you want to add anything to that?
You did cover most of it, but what I will add is that, to answer the questions in short, Colombo, particularly in the case of the Visigothic kingdom, as you requested, yes, at least to my understanding, these the federati, which were given that status, certainly earlier in a chronological sense, when the empire had more determination over where these barbarians would settle and where they would set up their client kingdoms. In the case of, say, the Visigothic kingdom, yes, of course, there's a consistency between the Visigothic kingdom taking up the province of Gallia Aquitania, because that was exactly what happened. That is where they were granted the original status of federati. Moreover, just to go on to AM's point that he talked about, the inheritance of institutions and the application of law and what have you. Interestingly enough, Hispania becomes, once the Visigoths reign supreme in Hispania and have more or less subjected the Suebi to sort of like a client status of their own, the greatest recollection of late Roman sort of pre-Islamic application of Roman law is not in Italy, it's not even in Gaul, it's actually in Hispania. And if you were to read Chris Wickham's The Inheritance of Rome, you'll actually discover that. And it's quite an interesting insight that you would not think that Hispania was the province where these records would be most intact, but there you go.
Well, I think, sadly, you know, this is very much a focusing on Italy, and the overall theme is, you know, France and Germany. Hopefully we'll come back to doing a Spain stream another time. But yes, I think overall that the point is granted about the survival of these institutions and the continuation of Rome. But sort of moving on in terms of the chronology. So from 461 until 472, we have the age of Ricimer. Ricimer, who is, I believe he's Suevi, and he's also Vandal. Am I right?
I believe so, but there is some debate about some of these figures. Like, I know there's debate about Odoacer and his exact tribe as well. So I think there's a sort of there's a mix between the Vandals and the Goths at points, but I can't say.
Well, the significance of Ricimer is that he is never in a position where he can become emperor himself due to his lineage, his barbarian lineage, in the same way that Stilicho could never seriously take on the position of Roman emperor either. However, he effectively controls all of the Roman emperors during this point until Anthemius arrives. To put this in perspective, now that the Western Roman Empire is looking like it's going to, you know, collapse everywhere, the Eastern Roman Empire, having taken a very laissez-faire attitude to all of this, is beginning to get politically involved in the running of the Western Roman Empire, and they suggest Anthemius to come and, you know, restore order to the Western Roman Empire. And the significance of the thing about Anthemius is, you know, he's a competent general. And he would be seen as, you know, a great unifying figure to bring the East back on side. And, you know, Ricimer, rather than welcoming this figure, you know, immediately works to try and undermine him and will eventually betray him and murder him. And to make matters worse, you know, after he's betrayed him, I think it's in 472, you know, again, frustrating any hope of Roman restoration, because Ricimer is just happy to rule behind the scenes, even though the empire is completely collapsing around him. He dies, I believe it's of a nosebleed or something, or some sort of
probably pneumonia. Alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, some sort of alcohol poisoning. And you know, rather than being replaced by another effective Roman general, the power behind the throne temporarily moves to the Burgundian war chieftain Gundobad. And it's not until 474 where you have, you know, a last desperate pitched attempt to try and restore order in the Western Roman Empire. And it's done through two contenders. One is the candidate supported by the Eastern Roman Emperor, being Zeno at this time. And that would be Julius Nepos, who would become Roman Emperor in 474. But there's also a civil war within the empire at this point, led by the Magister Militum Orestes, who wants to place his son Romulus Augustulus on the throne of Rome at the same time. Would you like to, anyone, explain a bit more about the last couple of years of the Roman Empire regarding Orestes and Romulus Augustulus?
I couldn't speak to it apart from that it's maybe a bizarre joke of providence, the name, but in terms of the exact specifics of the constitutional dealings of the time, I couldn't say.
Well, there is something specific to do with the name. Of course, Romulus Augustus was the intended name, and it caused such an outrage that, and again, Orestes was the father of Romulus Augustus, you know, again, believing, you know, have an emperor who he could control. He didn't make himself emperor, you know, for reasons which we'll probably never know.
Yeah, definitely.
But the position Augustulus, of course, is a diminutive form, I think, meaning little Augustus. So that was, you know, all that was accepted in terms of the actual title of him. But like I mentioned, you know, Julius Nepos is forced out of power, and I believe he relocates to Dalmatia. And this is the time where Odovaker comes on the scene. Does anyone want to go into the background of Odovaker?
Odovaker's background, there's a lot of debate. Some think he's a Goth, some think he's a Vandal. But yeah, he comes in and effectively, I believe he's the first to truly take over Italy and stabilize his conquest over Italy.
Oh, just before we get there, before we get to the actual conquest of Italy, so the build up towards the end of the Roman Empire in the West. Columba?
In terms of his background, I couldn't.
All right. Okay, well, just to give you a quick summary then, Odovaker is one of the, again, federati leaders. And like I said, the effective position of the Roman emperor towards the end is essentially mediating between all of these barbarian chieftains who tentatively pay homage to Rome. And then, as we see with Alaric, will side to then betray the Roman emperor, the same with Ricimer. Odovaker, I believe, is a federati leader who launches a rebellion when I believe Orestes is not forthcoming. I believe it's in payment or some sort of military position, and ends up leaving a revolt against Orestes and murdering him at the end of August of 476. And this is the significant thing. Rather than, you know, traditionally, if Odovaker had been Ricimer, he would have taken control of the young emperor Romulus Augustulus. And he would have ruled, like Ricimer had, as Magister Militum, basically controlling the Roman Empire behind the scenes. But significantly, he chooses not to. Instead, he takes Ravenna, which is, you know, then the capital of the Western Roman Empire, and he pensions Romulus Augustulus off. And, you know, even though he won't live very long, and there is a living Roman emperor in the form of Julius Nepos, who has gone temporarily into exile, it's quite significant the fact that he decides to rule alone. And as we can see, he will have a shortfall in terms of legitimacy as a result of this. Just to give you, you know, a quick summary, in order for the Eastern Roman Empire to be content with this new regime in Italy without a Western Roman emperor, Odovaker is created as a patrician of Italy. And nominally, he's in a very complicated position of being the vassal of Emperor Zeno, but also nominally a vassal of Julius Nepos at the same time, who is, again, kind of the Roman emperor, but in name only, from 476 until 480. Is there any sort of theory amongst you two fine gentlemen as to why Odovaker chose to remove Romulus Augustulus rather than rule behind the throne as Ricimer had done?
Perhaps pride, perhaps the imperial title had become so undesirable by this point that he wanted to reestablish rule along his own lines. That's certainly a possibility, but pride is also a serious possibility.
Marcus?
I could probably come at this for a couple of angles. One, because we're obviously focusing on Italy, and hopefully we can sort of delve into more detail as the stream goes on, but one thing is we have to mention, and this becomes very apparent further down the line when we talk about the consequences of Belisarius's Ostrogothic War. But even so, these sackings of Rome, these attacks throughout the Italian peninsula, these raids, and this changing of territory from the Vandals to the Ostrogoths to the Romans reestablishing themselves and then losing it again, it is impacting Italy comprehensively. And the population centers are already suffering at this point. Productivity of Italy has suffered at this point. Trade is rapidly diminishing. And so I think when a strong man like Otto Asse comes along, probably it's probably an inclination that, say, Urissima might have had, but wasn't able to follow through quite in the same way that Otto Asse was. But I guess there's a sense with strong men that you just want to establish order. And you wish to have a domain which actually functions and is able to at least achieve some degree of productivity and stability, and to reestablish trade and to be able to have some degree of agricultural productivity, because those things are the backbone not only of the state but also of an army, and both those things are very, very necessary at this point in time in history.
Yes, but he does get his comeuppance, doesn't he? Because he falls out with
yes. We'll talk about that in a second. But yes, Marcus.
Sorry,
you bring up a very important point, which is about the territorial inviolability of the Roman Empire. Even though, as you can see, the empire in fact is collapsing, the Roman Empire has never formally relinquished any of these territories we're talking about. In fact, there will be, as we mentioned on our first stream, Sigadius would have his own kingdom of Soissons, which would claim to be, as we can see in the map as well, there is a large portion of Gaul which is still loyal to Rome, and that would be one of the last holdouts even after Italy. There is still an imperial claim to all of these territories, and one of the reasons why Ricimer decides to remove Anthemius is because Anthemius, again, is intent on utilizing the Federati to reconquer the empire as Majorian had. There is this conception that the Western Roman Empire, despite, again, a very important point to note, which I haven't mentioned, in, I believe it's 410, the province of Britannia is voluntarily abandoned by the Roman Empire so they can focus more on the Rhine frontier.
That famous letter by Honorius to the Britons. Look to your own defences.
Yes, exactly. So, but besides Britannia, the rest of the Roman Empire is still considered the Roman Empire. And so this idea of reconsolidating a smaller territory and adopting the lowlier position of patrician head of the of what would later become the Ostrogothic kingdom, or just the state of Italy, the provinces of Italy, does have a certain attraction to it for someone who is ambitious but not so ambitious as to try and restore the entire empire in one fell swoop. And as we've seen, even Majorian failed in that endeavor. So I do believe there is some credence with that approach of wanting to consolidate smaller centers of power which are easier to control, rather than having this overarching aspiration towards the restoration of the whole empire, which wouldn't really manifest until Justinian, which we'll eventually get to.
Definitely, yeah. 100% agree.
So,
I missed the second point about my Italy thing. It's very brief. I think also you have, with the rise of these strongmen at the end of the Roman Empire, to this acknowledgement that Rome itself is very much a mortal thing, and that the emperors themselves become increasingly what's the word I could use? Like sort of castrated in a power, in a real politics sense. Yeah. And I think Otto Asse just realizes that it's a fait accompli almost at this point, and he's in a position just to become essentially the king of Italy, and he can do it, and he does do it. I think that's also a thing to consider.
Yes, and I think what is very significant to point out is he's able to force on the Eastern European, the Eastern Empire, a new power dynamic, where beforehand they had, with Anthemius, with Julius Nepos, they had tried to impose a Western Roman emperor when, you could say, the Western Roman, again, important to note that Romulus Augustus himself, in terms of his legitimacy, was in doubt, because Orestes had fought a civil war against Julius Nepos. So having him on the throne could have invited a war with the Eastern Roman Empire. So various reasons as to why he decided to adopt the lowlier position. But before we move on to Odovaca's comeuppance under Theodoric the Great, does anyone have anything to say, last remarks on the actual fall of the Western Roman Empire before we move on beyond that point?
I would also note God, I mean, the art gets absolutely atrocious, I suppose. I mean, everybody knows the outward symptoms of what happens, I suppose. In terms of the reasons, I think it's been covered very well. Debasement of currency, barbarian intrusion, increasing bureaucracy until it becomes stultifying, and division of power. I would say you can't do much better than that, to be honest. I think it's been covered pretty well.
I have to also point out Gibbon's infamous remark that Christianity was it's because of Christianity that so much of the Roman institutions actually survived and even survived to this day. So just have to put that out there. Marcus?
Two things. Another sort of thing to reflect about Otto Asser is that we spoke about Gaul. Actually, we all sort of roughly referenced it in the Gallic chat that we had a couple of weeks ago. It has sort of how Gaul is this sort of last sort of standard of West Roman power in Western Europe. And the domain of Syagrius is this sort of holdout in northwestern Gaul, which is sort of a reflection of the integration of the Gauls into Rome. There's another relatively intact portion of the empire which has less attention. That is the province of Dalmatia, which is at this point is commanded by a general named Ovidio, and he's very cynically attacked, and I believe he's executed by Otto Asser. So the fact that Otto Asser gets his comeuppance is kind of twice deserved in this respect, because I think he was a bit concerned that Ovidio might either defect to the East Roman Empire or might have designs on Italy himself. But he takes the initiative and attacks him first and incorporates Dalmatia into his domain.
Mm. And to make matters worse, Julius Nepos, who is still nominally the emperor of the Western Roman Empire at this point, is murdered at the same time. So Odovaca has a complete sort of freefall in terms of legitimacy. And Zeno probably correctly anticipates that the attack on Dalmatia could be seen as, you know, portentous of Odovaca attacking the Eastern Roman Empire itself. Now, on this map, it's also important to consider this little area, which is modern-day Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Croatia, and Hungary, which is the Ostrogothic kingdom. In 488, Emperor Zeno would encourage Theodoric the Great, the king of the Ostrogoths, to invade the provinces of Odovaca. And after 5 years of a series of like indecisive, you know, battles, they would come to like an agreement where they would partition the empire between themselves, you know, the lingering elements of Pannonia, Dalmatia, and Italy. However, Theodoric the Great famously betrays Odovaca, and I believe he splits him in half personally.
Yes, at dinner, I believe. They're having like a feast, and Theodoric apparently kills him with his own hands. Yeah. There's a dramatic moment in history for you.
Mm. How cleaving.
Now, I'll just get up a map of the new situation. Now we've moved on from there. Just give me second. So we have the Ostrogothic kingdom here, which, like I said, it contains the provinces of Italy, a bit of Gaul, a bit of the old provinces of Transalpine Gaul, Cisalpine Gaul, and obviously Pannonia, Raetia et Noricum, and the provinces of Dalmatia at the same time. Now, the significance of Theodoric in terms of trying to find some sort of continuity with the empire is that, unlike Odovaca, whose loyalty to the Eastern Roman Empire was always tenuous, Theodoric is, in addition to being a great warrior and, you know, capable of amazing deceit and, you know, personal acts of, you know, barbarism with his killing of Odovaca, he's a very accomplished diplomat and a incredibly canny politician. When you have the ushering in of the Ostrogothic kingdom, Theodoric is very conscious to establish it as the kingdom of the Goths and of the Romans. And he allows the Western Roman Senate, just to give you a bit of context of that, of course, there was the Roman Senate, which continued to exist even after the Tetrarchy. What really undermined the influence of the Senate was the Emperor moving outside of Rome, you know, to the four cities that we've mentioned, including Diocletian, who was the main emperor, moving to Nicomedia. But to make matters worse, when Constantine created Constantinople, the new city of the Eastern Roman Empire, they created a Eastern Senate at the same time. And many of the influential senators moved over there as well, further undermining the significance and the influence of the Western Senate. However, it still existed at this point, and this would be, you know, the nucleus of the Roman aristocracy, which we'll see in the medieval ages. So nevertheless, he tries to court the West Roman Senate to hold on to a system of legitimacy, and he prostrates himself before Emperor Zeno, you know, declaring himself to be the viceroy of the Roman provinces in the West. And we also have the continuation of the Roman system of administration, the continuation of the legal system. And as we also see through the provinces themselves, that it does cover a lot of the old the Roman provincial systems of administration at the same time.
It is interesting, though, you do see a sort of a division springing up between the Roman and the Germanic aristocracies in the kingdom, in terms of all of the military posts, like, yes, Magister Militum, are all taken up by the Germanics, and
yes,
the
exactly.
The Praetorian Prefecture and the Magister Quibulum, I believe, sort of civil magistrate. These posts are taken up by Romans. I mean, one of the most famous, of course, I believe, Boethius was under one of these positions, one of these civil posts. So yeah, you see that sort of separation building up, which I think is really interesting to note. In terms of people might be a bit confused on why it would be a Praetorian prefect, but again, we've talked about how power and bureaus, I mean, we know what bureaucracies do. We've seen it in our own age. They grow and grow and grow and take on more and more responsibilities. And the Praetorian prefect, the head of the Praetorian Guard, by this late point, had become a master of spies, in charge of supplying the army, in charge of administration, in charge of a lot of the scribes and bureaucrats. And it's kind of similar to what you see with the Khan of the Janissaries in the Ottoman Empire, where they accumulate all these powers and roles to the office. I thought I'd note that.
He almost becomes like a quartermaster in chief, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I mean, it must be quite, you know, emasculating for the Romans. You know, there's this incredibly proud Roman martial lineage, and here they are basically kept by the Gothic military caste. It's really quite extraordinary.
Yes, but I mean, they still produce great wonders. I mean, you have Boethius, like who I mentioned, who is arguably the last great Latin author of antiquity, and also one of the most strident defenders of Catholicism against many of the heresies of Manichaeanism and Arianism at the time. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but Theodoric was an Arian. But again, you mentioned, you know, he's a canny politician, and so he didn't go after the Catholics he tried to have them live alongside each other, but some people do think that Boethius's religious views were part of the reason for his fall and for Theodoric abandoning it. I've read that.
But nevertheless, I think that's a very important point you bring up, which is the religious policy. And again, this is this enables Theodoric to survive this period as well. I mean, you mentioned like Orthodox, you know, Catholic Christianity, or Chalcedonian Christianity after the 451 Council.
That was the word I was looking for.
But the significant point is that both the East and the West are going to have their various heretical moments. And this is going to be a key sort of build up towards the creation of the papal states at the end of the time frame we're going to discuss this evening. During the late reign of Emperor Zeno, you have something called the Acacian Schism, whereby you have the attempt to create a uniform religious policy for the empire called the Henoticon. And the reason this was controversial is that it offered, as far as I believe, some political concessions to the Monophysites, which was a heretical section. And to make matters worse, within the Eastern Roman Empire, after Zeno died, he was replaced by Athanasius, who was himself a... or was it Anastasius? one of the other.
Anastasius.
Anastasius. Thanks, Marcus.
Of course, I'm Sure.
And basically the Monophysites, you know, entered in the ascendancy, and as we see, this even formed part of the chariot racing cliques within the Byzantine Empire at the same time. So it wasn't actually necessarily of great political expediency to be a Orthodox adherent to Chalcedonian Christianity. In fact, you know, being a heretic meant that Theodoric could just watch and observe as the conflicts between the Pope and the Emperor in the East played out, and he was able to take, you know, essentially a neutral role. You know, in particular, this would be Pope Symmachus against Emperor Anastasius.
Yeah. He's a remarkably canny figure, Theodoric, and he was in charge. He ruled the empire for something like 30 years, I believe, or his kingdom, rather.
493 until 526. Yeah. And you mentioned the empire. I mean, one of the points I'm going to mention, of course, he's very conscious to, you know, continue Romanitas even under the shield of a Gothic military administration. What's important to consider is that he, as I mentioned, he's also a very able diplomat. So whilst he's, you know, weathering these religious conflicts and just he still maintains, you know, his Arian beliefs, but he's, you know, tolerating Chalcedonian Christianity at the same time. And
he was raised in the Eastern court, wasn't he?
Yes,
I think he was a hostage as a child. Yeah, so I assume he received a Roman education there. And so, yeah, it's remarkable to see him sort of weave these things and sort of emphasize his Romanitas when he feels he wants to, and sort of move to the background other times. I mean, I would say another big part of which demonstrates his knowledge of imperial history is his building program, right? Mm. You know, I mean, Augustus famously, you know, I found Rome a city of bricks, I left it a city of marble. And this isn't just some platitude. Great building programs were intimately associated with the idea of a good emperor, of a great emperor. And so even though he's not fully explicit, and he does homage to Zeno, he embarks on a massive building project, not only in Italy, but throughout his other holdings as well. I mean, and some of these things are for the period, remarkable. I mean, his own mausoleum, which I think is in Ravenna. You can still go and see it.
Yeah.
A lot of the architecture at the time is done with sort of brick, you know, the sort of the Roman tufa brick, which is, you know, I mean, it can look okay, but it gets dilapidated and it's not as impressive. But his mausoleum is carved stone blocks, you know, with arches as well. So a very fine structure. And he also built multiple basilicas. So, yeah, he's someone who's very conscious of what it means to be a good emperor and what the Romans will like.
Well, talking about arts, sorry, Marcus, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's funny you touched on that, Columba, because it brings up something which, you know, for those of us who are keen students of history, we do know about this in varying degrees, and that's all well and good. But for a lot of people who aren't particularly keenly aware or well-read on history of this period, and be it, you know, real classical history or this sort of gradual movement towards the end of the classical period, is that, you know, you look at the way the Romans and Greeks much earlier in history write about barbarians, whether they're talking about the Germanic tribes or the Gauls or what have you, there is this sort of mental picture of unwashed barbarians, and, you know, they all go into a cesspit and they're all dirty and they have unpaved streets and they don't bathe and that sort of stuff. But even though we sort of debunked, or at least uncoupled some of that in the chat about Gaul and to some lesser degree about the Germans last week, you know, it really brings into emphasis this idea and this conception that the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, certainly the Vandals — I actually have a nice thing to touch on that when we get to Justinian in the Vandalic War, have a nice quote for that — but that these sort of Germanics aren't really terrifying, ugly, uncivilized barbarians, but actually in some regard appreciate what Rome was, and they seek to keep the inheritance of Rome intact and sort of themselves become Roman, much to some degree the way the Romans became a little bit Hellenized, the barbarians have become Romanized by having conquered Roman territories.
Yes, and that's a very important theme, and this is my argument for the continued endurance of Rome and Romanitas all the way up to the end of the First World War. but anyway, in terms of this
Romanitas, but no, yes, Romans, my friend.
Yes, in terms of this this wonderful legacy. Well, this is Romanitas with Romans at the same time. You mentioned the artistic and the architectural heritage of the kingdom of Theodoric, the Ostrogothic kingdom. Of course, you have those beautiful mosaics. And of course, the famous image of a diminutive Christ, obviously indicating the Arian belief that Christ is not consubstantial with the Father and somehow lesser than God, which, you know, defies the Trinitarian beliefs. But something I want to bring up, of course, we have the beautiful, can't remember which church it is, but the church in Ravenna, which has that incredible mosaic image of the Emperor Justinian and the Empress Theodora.
San Apollinare, maybe?
I'll take your word for it. There is a similar image, an older image of Theodoric in the same style. Could you, this is an interesting point. Could you say that it was the Goths that were influenced by Roman styles, or that the later Byzantine Empire or Eastern Roman Empire in Italy would be influenced by Gothic styles?
I would argue that the Goths were trying to ape the Eastern Roman architectural styles, particularly because you see Theodoric next to his mausoleum. I believe he built a sort of palace or mansion for himself, and it was built in the same style that we see in the East, with, you know, kind of, if you picture Hagia Sophia with the domes and sort of the smaller minarets, I believe it was Theodoric who built a palace.
Well, Hagia Sophia is later than Theodoric, but yes, that general style.
But the style was already developing at this time. So I would argue that it's them trying to ape this, because I mean, as Marcus points out, they want to interact within the Roman administration, and there are some things which they find disquieting and they don't like. But there are other parts that they're really keen on, and the building is a big part of that. And if it can help legitimize your rule at the same time, and perhaps, who knows, display your and increase your relationship with the East, then it's a win-win. I mean, I would assume in the building of these structures that they must have had architects and men from the East to build them. That's a guess, but a pretty good guess to make. So I would argue that way.
Yes, apparently the church is San Vitale in Ravenna.
I've never
been there. Thank you, Marcus. I've never been there, but hope to go there one day. But
without a vaccine.
Yes. No frank punditry on this stream. Thank you very much.
Just on that note, AM, is that if you see the San Vitale there in Ravenna, you see the mosaics we're talking about. If you go to Monreale in Sicily, it's different. Different mosaics, different pictures you see, but the art style is actually different. Even though their time scale is a little bit different, there's almost some mimicking even within the context geographically of Italy, that there's sort of things that get constructed towards the end of the empire are in fact mimicked elsewhere later on.
And again, in terms of the various artistic styles, you know, sadly, I don't know enough about it to comment, you know, at great length about it. But moving back to the, I could almost say Theodoric the Great is almost like a generalissimo or potentate of the Western Roman Empire, even though it failed to exist, even though there's only one emperor, just the Roman emperor in the East, which is Anastasios. And then he would die and be replaced by Justin, the father of Justinian, who would resolve the religious disputes by, you know, abjuring monophysitism from the position of the emperor. The amazing thing about Theodoric is also he's this great mediator between the Franks and the Visigoths. He's not able to, and the Burgundians as well, he's not able to stop a war between them, but you could almost say that he's kind of like the great mediator of all the former provinces of the Roman Empire during this period.
I just wanted to say you were talking about much of the trends of later history being established in this period, and I would say that this to me reeks of in the Middle Ages when we see overlordship. I mean, famously in the dispute about the Scottish succession, they brought in a great king in the form of Edward the First to mediate the dispute. So we see these sorts of things growing and growing and becoming more common. It's how you do things.
The complex nature of suzerainty, and we move on, of course, into feudalism during this time as well. But in terms of his diplomatic success, I believe he was actually able to be elected not just king of the Ostrogoths, but also king of the Visigoths for a decade before he died in 526. So you have this, 523. So you have this incredible period where he rules roughly about half of the former Western Roman Empire, including the provinces of Hispania, Southern Gaul, Pannonia, and Dalmatia at the same time.
Was he not actually called Augustus by some?
Yes, but he wouldn't have sort of publicly gone along with that title because, again, he was very clear to show his deference to Eastern Roman Empire. So it may have been, a common epithet, but very much, one he would have been shrewd
smacked
enough
down when he heard of it,
or to utilize. Yes. So we mentioned, of course, what's going on in the East. We have Justin, and in 523, Theodoric the Great dies after a reign of 30 years, which is, quite incredible considering how unstable the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the instability it brought to all of Western Europe. And to make matters worse, he doesn't have a strong successor to replace him. Instead, there is his child grandson, Athalaric. And for the regency, he, again, tries something very Roman. He places his daughter, Amalasunta, I might have mispronounced the name, as the regent of the kingdom, and she would rule over the Ostrogothic domain from 523 until 534. And the significance about her is that she's Roman educated, and she very much wants to continue this Gothic rapprochement between the Senate and also the Eastern Roman Empire at the same time.
Definitely, yeah.
So much so that she lends, I believe, military bases in Sicily to allow the Eastern Roman Empire to deal with the Vandal threat, the massive naval threat. Of course, the Vandals being a naval superpower during this time period. So ironically, it's not the Romans who are frustrated with this regime, which you can say is the continuation of Romanitas post the empire. But the Goths are frustrated with this regime because you have this woman ruling over, as a regent of a child, on behalf of a Roman emperor. The Gothic element of the Ostrogothic kingdom is declining. So she has to rely on her cousin, Theodahad, to essentially bolster her regime. And to make matters worse, Athalaric dies very young. He dies in 3-4, and so she has a crisis of legitimacy, and she has to find a king to replace, because obviously she is a queen. The idea of a Gothic queen at this point is almost absurd.
Yeah, and the sole justification was she was sort of a protector, right?
Yes, exactly. She was the protector on behalf of the grandson.
There's a slight irony here, actually. I'll just be very quick. That if you look at German societies, and we sort of touched on this last week, is that they very much had a much more profound degree or obvious degree of, you might say, egalitarianism between genders, right?
Yeah.
Yet, as the Ostrogoths have Romanized, and we have a Roman system of a mother being essentially a consort regent to the son, in this case, we're discussing, Athalaric, that the Gothic aristocracy, essentially, the Gothic leadership, have immense qualms with Amalasuntha staying in power. There's an interesting irony there to consider.
Hmm.
It's certainly a consideration. I could argue against it, but I see what you're saying. But I think even the barbarian German tribes centuries before, I mean, they might have had a prophetess occasionally who would excite their religious fervor, but I think the idea of being regularly ruled by queens would have been distasteful to them.
I mean, I was sort of, being quite vague. It's more of a food for thought thing than me sort of staking
my knowledge on it,
Sorry, Ian, yes. Go on.
But no, yes, and setting up this idea of Amalasuntha sort of looking almost like a Roman Livia as opposed to a Gothic seeress. But anyway, so this creates a crisis of legitimacy. The only relative left is Theodahad, who is a cousin of Athalaric. And to make matters worse, she brings in Theodahad believing that she will protect the young boy. And when Athalaric dies, he basically positions himself to become king. And I believe she wants to be queen at some point. There's a little conflict between them, but obviously, she loses. And Theodahad imprisons Amalasuntha. And she, appeals to Justinian for help.
And, this is his casus belli, right?
This is his casus belli. And of course, Theodahad, believing that Amalasuntha is trying to appeal to the Eastern Roman Emperor to undermine his regime. Again, you have the fundamental sort of irony in this regime. It's dependent on the Roman Empire for legitimacy. It tries to embody Rome, and yet they are trying to maintain a military political situation which is independent of the Roman Empire. So when Theodahad appealed, you know, when Amalasuntha appeals to Justinian, that is ultimately undermining his own authority. And so he ends up killing her. And this is the casus belli for Justinian. I think, yes, therefore it's important to note before we get into the background of Justinian, I'm sure Marcus would be far more versed on that topic than me. It's interesting how the weird situation is that Rome needs a pretext to reconquer its own possessions. And it's because you have this weird administration where you have a Gothic military regime ruling in a Roman way, ostensibly under a Roman emperor, where they're able to preserve the legitimacy of this regime, and that Justinian would need a pretext to reconquer his own possessions.
I have a somewhat bit of a devil's advocate position on this regarding the casus belli. I don't think it's so much Justinian using it as a means to justify the conquest of Gaul specifically, but more that given the early part of Justinian's reign being rather tumultuous, and for those who don't know, Justinian takes over. He's the heir to his uncle Justin. He is popular in some elements of the aristocracy and is considered lukewarm towards the populace, but he alienates the populace rather early on in his reign. Yeah. A lot of people don't like the fact he's married Theodora, who was essentially a child of the circus and has a somewhat cloudy past. Let's just keep it PG rated.
Yes, for people who are interested, do check out my Byzantine stream with Semiagog and Pharaoh talking about the supposed sordid history and the secret history of the Empress Theodora.
But very Roman, I suppose.
Let's just say it's extraordinarily colourful. And of course, and you probably would have touched on this on the Byzantine stream as well, I assume, is that it culminates in the Nika riots, and the Nika riots are probably an instance of one of the largest urban revolts that's ever taken place. And tens of thousands of people are actually killed in the suppression of this revolt. So I think Justinian, from that perspective, I consider the casus belli more as a domestic tool for him to rally the aristocracy and the populace to firstly undertake the Vandalic campaign, which ends up being far more successful than anyone I think assumes, and then from the reconquered city of Carthage in North Africa, they then use that as a springboard to conquer Gothic Italy. And he does use that pretext of Amalasuntha requesting assistance as the legitimizing purpose for that campaign, in my view.
No, that's quite a good point. I think you convinced me. I was going to play devil's advocate and say, well, that could have just been a response to the Vandalic kingdom. But nevertheless, I think build upon the success of General Belisarius and the possibility of quickly, and indeed it is quick, the first conquest from 535 to 540. There is this expectation that Italy could be conquered quickly and with minimal loss of life under Belisarius. And indeed, I think the point to mention is that Theodahad, who has become king at this point, does make, you know, several you know, peace offers to Justinian, claiming that he will uphold the status quo so long as, you know, Justinian left him alone. The fact that Justinian ignores him and he chooses to accept the Amalasuntha pretext to invade, it's controversial to say the least, looking at things in hindsight, because the conquest doesn't go very well in the long term, let's say. But I think before we get to that, would you like, Marcus, because I'm sure you're better versed at it than I am, to talk about the actual process of the reconquest of Italy by Belisarius?
Sure. Just before we complete the part, the Vandals, I said they had a small quote pertaining to them. If I may share it, it's actually from Gelimer, speaking from the first person. And this actually buttresses the point I was mentioning, 10 or so minutes ago about how this, in the same way that the sort of Romans were Hellenized early in the history, that the sort of Germans have been Romanized by having conquered these provinces. And this quote from Gelimer is a very touching, sort of almost poignant point that sort of buttresses that claim. Upon the Roman conquest of North Africa and following the siege of Carthage, when Belisarius completes the Roman conquest of North Africa, Gelimer says this: to Belisarius. I ask for three things. A loaf, because I've not eaten properly since the invasion. A sponge, to dry my eyes because I'm weeping for the loss of my kingdom. And a harp, to accompany myself on the ode that I've written about my downfall. Hardly the words of a savage.
Hmm. And you could say that the Vandals, in addition to, I mean, essentially all of them, you can even say that the Franks at this stage, I mean, there is definitely a decline, but they are Romanized and they are educated. And like I said, it's the fundamental difference from the Germans we were encountering last week to the post-Romanized Germans that we have this week. But before moving on to Italy, I mean, you mentioned that wonderful quote by Gelimer. Would you like to elaborate a bit more on, you know, why the provinces in Africa were a good first target for Justinian?
Well, even though there was apprehension regarding the conquest initially, because like I was referencing just previously, Justinian's regime got off to an extraordinarily rocky start, and he was by no means assured of his position. Even though he had suppressed the Nicorites, he was still not particularly liked by many elements of both the aristocracy and the populace. And Belisarius is one of his most trusted generals who does cut his teeth in the East. He actually campaigns to some degree of success against the Sassanids, successfully defends the fortress city of Dara against Sassanid attack in an exceptional battle. So then he's given control of this invasion force, which a large number of people within the command structure of the East Empire are apprehensive about, because other emperors had tried, I believe Zeno had tried with a much larger invasion force, approximately three times the size of Belisarius's, and failed. And as you mentioned before, Majorian from the west tried to reconquer Africa and he's lost his fleet, and that didn't work out either. But Belisarius lands very close to Carthage. I believe he lands somewhere in the proximity of the city of Hadrumetum. He advances upon Carthage. He engages them at a place called, I think, Ad Decimum, which essentially is a mile marker that marks, I think, 100 miles from Carthage. He sends his bodyguard cavalry to the fore as a vanguard. They come into contact with Gelimer's brother, who's commanding Vandalic cavalry. He's Gelimer's brother slain in this initial engagement. Gelimer becomes distraught at the fact that his brother has died. From that point on, Gelimer sort of offers almost token resistance. The Byzantines, or the East Romans, advanced upon Carthage. They do manage to take Carthage, and once the Vandals attempt to retake Carthage with their assembled forces, and Gelimer's other brother having arrived from Sardinia with the second portion of their army, but Belisarius does best them outside the city. He sallies out of Carthage, and he does defeat the Vandalic forces. From which point, the Vandals don't really have much else to fight them with, and essentially relinquish the campaign to Belisarius after essentially a siege and two battles.
Is it possible, because I know with the conquest of Italy by Belisarius, that at least to some degree a lot of the citizens in places like Rome, a lot of the Roman people, I suppose, were I believe, you know, they opened the gates of Rome to Belisarius, and there was this sense of I suppose we're being in some sense liberated from the Goths, or so do you think there was any sort of considerations of that sort in the African campaign, or is that a stretch too far?
No, absolutely. And for anyone who's interested, because I do see occasional comments, people asking about source and whatever, if you want to read about Belisarius and or his campaigns or just his general sort of life, there is the Life of Belisarius written by Lord Mahon, and Belisarius, the Last Roman General by Ian Hughes. And I cannot recommend those two books more. As you're asking, Columba, about the populace, certainly in the urban centre, certainly in the large coastal trading centres with significant populations, they do see the East Romans as being the, you know, the rightful owners and custodians of this territory. The citizens themselves more or less see themselves as Romans, and the army coming towards them are Romans. And Belisarius makes a point, because a large portion of his army is in fact not Roman citizens. It's approximately 50-50, but a certain part of his army are in fact Hunnic mercenaries. I believe he has Gothic mercenaries in his army, and Asaurians, and a whole mishmash of other sort of auxiliary units. And he explicitly says to them, do not loot, do not pillage. We are reconquering territories. These are Romans. You're being paid by Rome, and these are Roman citizens. He explicitly makes that clear to his forces, and they largely obey, particularly in Africa. Moreover, with Belisarius, he Sorry, I was going to make a second point, but I've actually gone blank. Sorry, continue, I am.
No, it's fine. But thank you again.
To the best of us.
Thank you again for that, the wonderful summary. Of course, the turning point isn't necessarily a military defeat. It's a major demographic disaster, which is the plague of Justinian, which hits in the year 540 to 541. And I believe it kills about a quarter of the population of the Roman Empire, including Italy. So it's a complete disaster in terms of the infrastructure and the wealth of Italy, but also destruction in terms of the manpower capabilities of the Eastern Roman Empire to be able to maintain the conquest. And in response, Theodahad had been deposed. The Ostrogoths rally behind a new general, Totila, and from 541 until 551, as far as I believe, you know, under General Narses as well as Belisarius.
Yes, because Belisarius is recalled, right?
Yes.
For I think the same reasons that we were talking about with Agricola and Stilicho. Absolutely. He becomes a threat because of his successes.
Absolutely. A very, very important consideration. Belisarius could theoretically have declared himself emperor of the Western Roman Empire. So there was a conscious attempt to avoid that eventuality. So the older and potentially, you know, less capable Narses was put in charge. And as a result, you had another 15 years of war. So from 551 to 554, the Byzantines were able to reconquer most of their possessions. And in 554, Justinian reorganizes the new constitution of Italy under the Pragmatic Sanction. Nevertheless, the war has gone on for 20 years instead of the original five, with the plague of Justinian and, you know, the constant a flipping of the cities. I believe most of the great urban centers are destroyed by this point. It takes, and to make matters worse, the Alemanni and the Franks also invade. And I think the Visigoths also invade at this point. So it takes until 562 for Italy to, you know, be entirely reconquered after the, you know, original conquest, which was 20 years before.
Exactly.
So, you know, the cities were, you know, crumbling. The great urban metropolises couldn't be supported by the countryside anymore, which, you know, itself was impoverished. So the effect of this, it was an incredibly costly campaign, which took much longer than the conquest of Africa.
What we should emphasize is, sorry, just on that point, Aim, I just want to get this in, is that the initial invasion of Italy is actually extremely successful and extremely rapid, not too dissimilar to Africa. More or less, the first hurdle they come up to is the siege of Neapolis, which is modern-day Napoli. And the city's taken because one of Belisarius's mercenaries finds like some defunct aqueduct, and they manage to scurry their way into the city. But it's Rome and the siege of Rome, and then the subsequent attacks in northern cities, because the southern cities aren't fortified, because Rome had, as a, you know, in its full and complete state, had no reason or motivation to fortify the southern cities.
Yeah.
The northern cities are a different question. From Rome north, including cities such as Arretium, Rimini, Ravenna, Mediolanum, famously, were all heavily fortified and had substantial walls of defences. And as this campaign is fluctuating back and forth, and we probably should mention the siege of Mediolanum, because that in itself is quite a catastrophe.
Sure, go ahead.
And you know, with the subsequent onset of the Justinian plague, because that occurs after Rome is reconquered as well. So the East Roman forces are on the cusp of an almost complete victory when the plague strikes, and it's this that really causes a loss of momentum. But on the siege of Mediolanum, I just want to quickly mention is that the city itself actually turns against its Ostrogothic masters and declares for Justinian and East Roman forces. And between the command, which is shared between John the Armenian, Narses, and Belisarius, is ostensibly the commander-in-chief, essentially, of the theater, if we can use modern-day terminology. Narses does not obey Justinian. John the Armenian, after a failed skirmish somewhere in Liguria, claim sickness. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but that's what the historians say. The garrison in Mediolanum is stranded, and they actually hold out for an extremely long time, the better part of a year, to my recollection. But because they're cut off and they're deep in enemy territory, they cannot last. And the Ostrogoths more or less offer them an offer they can't refuse, to use an Italian euphemism, that they would be spared their lives if they surrendered peaceably and opened the gates, and they did. The Goths spared the life of the garrison, but because the city revolted against the Ostrogoths, the population of Mediolanum is almost wiped out. And this is you might say, a portent for the eventual destruction between the plague, between the fluctuating campaign, the loss of East Roman momentum, and like you say, the influx of these other peoples. You have the Lombards pouring into Italy, the Franks getting involved, we'll hold on
to the Lombards for a second, but yes, definitely the other peoples.
And all these other factors contribute to this complete and utter devastation of Italy, to which...
War makes plague 10 times worse. This is another thing that the listeners should know. Exactly. When there's no food, there's no water, hygiene is out of bounds, there's loads of people moving around, not a good recipe.
And of course, in the context of military conquest and warfare and battles and what have you, if you're an attacking army besieging a city, you're cutting off the city's water, you're breaking down aqueducts, you're poisoning wells, you're doing all these things to sort of curtail your enemy in the context of engaging combat with the enemy in proximity. So this civil infrastructure is being undermined with the onset of plague in the context of an increasingly bitter war between these powers. I'll mention this thing I forgot about North Africa. It also applies to the Ostrogoths. What I was going to say is that you have these essentially barbarian regimes that have conquered, you know, Italy, North Africa, etc., and you have this essentially warrior elite, a militarized warrior elite of Germans. And once that elite is, you might say, culled and suffers attrition through battle, as what happened in the Vandalic War in North Africa, they more or less lose the capacity to fight because the populace largely see themselves as Roman. So this is why when Belisarius does essentially vanquish the cream of the Vandalic elite in North Africa, he's able to win quite quickly and quite successfully. Yeah. The problem with the Ostrogoths in the Ostrogothic War in Italy is that essentially a second wave of Ostrogoths sort of come into Italy from their other holdings in Pannonia, Dalmatia, etc. And this occurs at the same time that the East Romans lose momentum. So I just want to mention that thing about the aristocracy because it's important. It's a large part of the reason why the Vandalic War is quick and the first half of the conquest of Italy is also quick.
Are the East Romans not also fighting the Sassanids at the same time as well? Is there not an incursion from the East? Well,
that's a reason why Belisarius gets recalled the second time. Because the Sassanids reinvade. And Belisarius is essentially the only general at this point who's experienced in not only just fighting the Sassanids, but defeating them. Because I think Mundus might be retired at this point. I'm not too sure.
Hell of a man.
Yes.
So thank you for that, Marcus. So the point to emphasize is that it's a complete Pyrrhic victory, and the conquest has completely devastated Italy in addition to the plague. So the military campaigns, you could say, were ultimately useless at the end. You brought up the Langobards or the Lombards. The trek of the Langobards, you know, out of Scandinavia, you know, it's an epic journey in itself. Nevertheless, over the process of hundreds of years, they trek from Scandinavia, you know, cross the Elbe into southern Germany. And then finally, just before the complete reconquest of Italy in 562, the king of the Lombards or Langobards, Alduin, crosses over into Pannonia. And as we mentioned, you know, the evaporation of Ostrogothic authority in the extremity, so in Raetia at Noricum, in Pannonia. You know, the migrations are still going on during this period. Of course, we'll talk about the Slavs eventually migrating in the east. So the Lombards make a home in Pannonia in the same way that the Ostrogoths were positioned when Odovaker was king to launch a campaign in Italy. But funnily enough, they originally ally with the Romans against the Ostrogoths by joining into Justinian's Federati, and they fight against the Ostrogoths at the Battle of Tagne. However, when King Alduin dies, he's replaced by King Alboin. And in 568, Alboin moves from Pannonia, so in the northeast, as you can see on this map, and crosses over into northern Italy. And the Byzantines, because of their weakened position and because you mentioned the destruction of infrastructure, as a result of the destruction of the Vandalic kingdom, the Byzantines had reclaimed, or Western Romans had reclaimed, naval supremacy over the Western Mediterranean. And so they were able to reinforce and supply cities from the sea, cities like Ravenna, and eventually cities like Venice, which would become the Republic of Venice, and, you know, cities in the south in Sicily. However, in the interior, it was much more difficult to keep Roman armies supplied. So we have this situation, which I'll just bring up the ultimate map for this evening.
Just while I pull up the map, can I make a historical comparison here?
Yeah, sure.
For those of you familiar that are watching, who are familiar with modern history, there's a very strange kind of comparison to be made here, that a military force which is on the cusp of victory, that is also on the precipice of exhaustion, is actually at arguably this most vulnerable point. And there's a degree of sort of, again, like I said last week, history rarely repeats itself, but it very often rhymes, that the East Roman army at its maximum extent in Italy, at a point where it's quite vulnerable, is very similar to the fate actually of the Ostia in 1942 in Germany, the Battle of Stalingrad. Mm. If you are at the point of exhaustion, you must have finished the war. If you're on the point of exhaustion and still fighting, you are terribly, terribly vulnerable.
I think to give the German Sixth Army and Frederick Paulus a bit of credit, they were fighting an enemy which they knew existed. You know, I don't believe
Justinian
could have expected yet another Germanic.
Speaking as the defending force rather than the offensive force. Totally get it. Yes, yeah. Speaking in sort of broad military terms of just exhaustion and length of supply and that sort of stuff.
Exactly. But nevertheless, you couldn't have expected, because again, like we mentioned, they were able to hold off the already known threats such as the Alemanni and the Franks, but they weren't able to hold off against this new threat, which were the Langobards. And so they cross over, and as you can see from the map, they quickly take over northern Italy. From 572, they establish a capital. Albo and establishes his government in Pavia, which is just south of Milan, which will become the new Lombard kingdom. And from there, he conquers Tuscany, and he moves into southern Italy and establishes the two duchies of Benevento and Spoleto, and under, I believe, Zotto and Farold. And as you can see on this map, there is a little link between, you know, Ravenna and Rome here in Perugia. And this sort of weirdly separates the realm into two, which we'll see sort of going forward. However, rather sort of deceitfully, I think we mentioned in our last stream, it was how after the defeat at the Teutoburgerwald by Arminius against Lucius Varus, Tiberius was prepared to fight the Germans rather than engaging in treachery. This is, I think, where you get the more negative connotations behind the word Byzantine. In order to defeat Alboin, the Byzantines can't defeat him in battle, so they resort to a attempted coup d'etat using his wife Rosamond, who herself was the daughter of a Gepid king who had been killed by Alboin. And she successfully kills Alboin, but because of the strength of the Lombards themselves, this Byzantine coup d'etat fails, and Rosamond flees to Ravenna. But the overall effect of this, they're not able to overturn the conquest of most of Italy by the Lombards. However, they're able to cause the fragmentation of the nascent Lombard kingdom and prevent it consolidating into one large realm, which could have obviously eventually conquered all those little orange bits on the map.
I would note, in terms of why Lombard control was distributed like this, you mentioned the importance of naval supply. But if we think of the topography of Italy and we look at this map, I'm not an expert geographer, but I know that the blue areas on this map mostly correspond to the highlands. I mean, you have the
with the
Alps
exception
here
of the Po Valley, with Tuscany in the south. Yeah.
With the the Po Valley, a lot of it is actually taken up coming out of Ravenna there. But in terms of a lot of Etruria seems to be taken, and that's interesting because in the interior of Etruria starts to lead into the mountain range running down the center of Italy. But a lot of the coastal cities like Clusium were great trading centers and maritime centers from the time of going all the way back to the beginning of the Etruscan civilization. But generally we can note that the highlands are where the Lombards have control and where the Byzantines can be easily resupplied by sea. We see them establishing control. But of course, the corridor, I imagine, is where they concentrated most of their forces, for obvious reasons.
Yes,
exactly.
Indeed.
And if you see also, if you sort of analyze this map where the orange is, which is Romani di Oriente, which obviously means Romans of the East, this being an Italian map, obviously. But if you look at the sort of splatterings of sort of orange where it's not consolidated in that sort of central passage from Ravenna to Roma, which I don't know if we're going to touch on this AM, but essentially this becomes the Exarch of Ravenna.
Oh, we are going to touch on this.
We have the establishment of the Exarchs, because between the Sassanid Wars in the East, you have the Avars and the Slavs sort of pouring over the Danubian frontier. They obviously established these Exarchs to establish control and to try and hold these territories in the Eastern Mediterranean. What I do want to mention is that if you actually, for those of you who have been or wish to go to Italy at some point, and let's hope we can do that relatively soon, if you look at where these little splotches are, sort of just west of Benevento, you have sort of cities there around Naples and terminating in a little place called Gaeta. If you travel to these places, they still have magnificent fortifications that almost date back to this period. And it goes to show that the Romans sort of clung onto these coastal territories for an extremely long time, when the hinterland was long lost to the Lombards. In the south, you have Lecce and Bari down there, Brindisium, where east, if you go east of Benevento, with that little thing pokes out the ankle of Italy, you have the Castel Sant'Angelo. These fortifications were actually held by the East Romans for a relatively long time, and are in fact used for the springboard for the partial reconquest of the southern provinces later on.
Yes, and to put this in perspective, the Eastern Romans would maintain a presence into Italy until the Normans would, you know, ultimately round off and complete the conquest of southern Italy, even though the Arabs had already taken Sicily at this point as well, you know, before that. But that's moving sort of way ahead in the chronology.
And also the Sicilian conquest literally takes the Arabs 2 centuries anyway.
Yes, exactly. So moving back to what essentially happens, the political situation in Lombards, they fragment into 36 duchies. Of course, the word duchy coming from the Latin word duce, which means dukes, which means leader. Obviously, that's where we get the fascist notion of Il Duce from. So it gives the Byzantines some respite. And as you mentioned, there's this new restructuring of power. So in 584, the Romans established the Exarchate of Ravenna, obviously Ravenna, because Ravenna was the former center of political power in Italy. Although the Exarchate of Ravenna only applies to this area in the north. In the south, we have the governments of Sicily, which would later become the theme of Sicily. And paradoxically, the provinces of, you know, Corsica and Sardinia would actually be part of the viceroyalty, you know, the Exarchate of Africa at the same time, which would, I believe, fall to the Arabs in the late 7th century. So, you know, slowly all of these possessions would fall, but nevertheless, they're able to hold on to a series of territories and, of course, establish fortifications. Over the next 200 years, the Roman authority would, you know, relatively splinter and it would become devolved. And this is where, again, we have the emergence of feudalism in Italy. And of course, what's also important to mention is that the Byzantines control Rome at this point, and with it, they control the popes. And this is a period called the Byzantine Papacy, with the reconquest under Belisarius, who, with the remnants of the Roman Senate, would actually come to resent the authority of the Exarch. Because to put this in perspective, you still have the Roman senatorial aristocracy in Rome, and you have the Pope, and they are becoming increasingly independent as the Eastern Roman authority is slipping around them. And the Exarch is a viceroy placed there by the Eastern Roman Emperor. So he is still considered a foreigner to the aristocracy of the Roman Senate at this point. So we're having the rumblings of a new power structure, which will be, again, in terms of this stream, delineating points which will, you know, correspond to the next 1,000 years of Italian politics.
Yeah.
This
I mean, is, we have, know, we also have increasing increasing theological disputes, right?
Well, before we get to the theological disputes, because I'll leave that to when we get to Leo the Isaurian, which is when they really explode. But another interesting point to mention is that we mentioned the decline of the Roman army during this period, and how even, you know, Justinian, leading the Eastern Roman forces, was still relying on federati and, ironically, the Lombards. During this period, you have the emergence of town militias and little defense militias defending each city, you know, nominally on behalf of the Exarch. And here really is where we have the creation of, you know, little local pockets of authority, which would lead into the Italian city-state. So one thing to notice during this entire period is that there is decentralization happening within the Lombard sections, and there is decentralization happening within the Roman segments as well. You brought up, Marcus, earlier about the arrival of the Avars and the arrival of the Slavs. In the 7th century, the Slavs would begin to invade northern Italy. And I believe it's in 705 at the Battle of Socia, which establishes the definitive border between what is nowadays Slovenia and Italy, you know, even though that would be held by the Austrians. I think that is the ethnic border even to this day. But going back to quickly to the Langobards, I think it's important to note that they were also originally pagan, unlike the Ostrogoths, which were Aryan. And as we mentioned, that goes back to our last stream when it comes back to Ulfilas, converting the Gothic populations in the 4th century. The Langobards, who were later migrants and weren't Goths, you know, they were just Scandinavian Germans.
Yeah, they came from the far north.
Yes, were pagans, and they would convert to Arianism in a kind of an intermediary stage, but eventually in the 7th century, they would convert to Chalcedonian Christianity, even though the distinction between Catholic and Orthodox still doesn't really exist at this point as much. Yeah.
Although we do have the word Catholic being used, right?
But yes, not by both sides.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Strangely enough, you mentioned just a little while ago how the Langobards had this sort of monumental journey from Scandinavia, and they sort of eventually arrive in Italy via the German lands, would become the sort of center of the German world. Is that, you know, we spoke about it yesterday, because we obviously, last week, we spoke about Germania. The Langobards kind of almost bookend the Germanic Great Migrations. You sort of have we talked about the Cimbri last week, and how the Langobards are kind of like the Cimbri of the end of the era of antiquity, the sort of the end of the classical era. They booknote it quite, quite ironically.
Yes, and it's novel, isn't it? How, you know, all of these displaced groups, you know, from all over the world, and of all the groups, why it would be a group from, you know, lower Scandinavia which will rule over Italy and give
and exactly. And unlike the Cimbri, the Langobards succeed.
Yes, exactly.
I would also note, just as a little point, this is what would this be, the 6th century when these incursions are coming?
7th century.
Okay, so around that time, or in the century preceding, we had a lot of movements from South Scandinavia. I mean, this is when we see inroads into, this is when we see the creation of England, right?
So, of course, the original, as Marcus mentioned, the original interaction with the Germans was from the Cimbri and the Teutones, you know, coming from that area in Scandinavia. So there's a wonderful irony, the fact it would be from the same region who ultimately destroy the most of the Roman authority in Italy itself, coming from that same region. But going back to the legal codes, whilst the Lombards have no deference to the Eastern Roman emperors, they become, you know, as they become Catholic, they have deference to the popes, of course, and they maintain their own legal code. In 643, the king of Pavia, Rothari, codifies the first Lombard law. And this is, again, important to note that there is a separate Lombard law pertaining to the Lombards ethnically. You know, there are some settled Lombards, which are, you know, distinct from the Romans, but the Romans are still governed by Roman law during this period. And, you know, when we look at Rothari's code, it very much deals with elements of the Germanic law we were talking about in our last discussion, in particular dealing with blood money and the Wehrgilds. So the system, you know, survives in some form, even though elements such as the Lombard hairdress and, you know, clothing, all of that will be gone, and they'll become assimilated. And eventually their people would begin to speak dialects of Vulgar Latin. And to put this in perspective in terms of the language change, of course, Latin is still used in the church. It is still used as the language of administration, but Vulgar Latin is basically the deterioration of Latin all across Europe. But we don't see in Italy, especially, the arrival of anything distinctly Italian until we could almost say the 13th and the 14th century. So we're still, you know, a long way away in terms of getting the Italian language. Nevertheless, we are seeing the omnipresence of Vulgar Latin dialects all across this province, and indeed across most of the Western
Roman Empire. I don't know if you'd go this far, but in terms of trying to identify, you know, again, the trends that continue throughout the Middle Ages, we've talked about, and it's funny, when we did our stream on Gaul, Bronze Age Pervert actually did one of his podcasts on a similar subject, and he was pointing out, you know, a lot of the theories that go around about the creation of French aristocracy. You know, you have the Germanic Franks ruling over a Romanized or the Roman population of Gaul. So would you say that during Lombard Italy we see that same situation, or would you see it differently to the developments there? How would you view it in that regard?
Well, of course there is an aristocracy,
because you mentioned the separation of laws there.
And of course there was a substantial Lombard aristocracy, and again they were a devolved aristocracy in the sense that all of these duchies were independent to some degree, you know, paying nominal lip service to the Lombard king in Pavia. So yes, there is an element of the Lombard aristocracy which will continue and assimilate into the modern Italian aristocracy, together with the intervention of the Carolingians at the same time. But I think it's also important to note that in Italy in particular, we have various forms of authority. So we have a Germanic aristocracy on the one hand, we have the emergence of city-states and city militias on the other. We have the overseas imperial authority, and this is again a theme which is consistent to Italy. It's Italy being dominated by outsiders. So you'll have this during the Carolingian period, you have this during the Holy Roman Empire, you'll have this during the Italian Wars, you'll have this during the period of Habsburg dominance, you'll have this really up until the creation of a united Italian state in 870, because even at that last point, French consideration intervention was keeping the Italians from annexing Rome. So, yes, there are many themes which are established. And of course, the main source of power, which we're going to get into now, which is the emergence of the temporal power of the church. And by that, I mean the papacy in particular.
So could we say, just as an addendum to that great point that you've just made there, perhaps the reason for the extreme splintering that we see in Italy, even in comparison to the splintering that we see in other provinces in the West, is it perhaps that Italy, its infrastructure, political, social, technological, had developed to such a degree. I mean, if you look at maps of cities in ancient Rome, right? Urbanization, you have hundreds of cities in the Italian peninsula, and nowhere near as many elsewhere. So perhaps that extreme development that we see in the peninsula is the reason why we see such splintering of sovereignty and city states in Italy. But I don't know, maybe that's it sounds absolutely somewhat counterintuitive, but it's interesting.
And we are going to substantiate this when we go down further the chronological line. Yes, Marcus?
And I was just going to say there's another point we should touch on before we sort of leave this this picture and this sort of subject, because we have talked about the plague. And we've talked about the Gothic War in Italy and the effects and the arrival of the long Langobardi. But I do have a quote here from Procopius that actually quantifies to some degree the plague. And if I don't sort of get in now, I think we're going to miss it. So do you mind if I repeat the quote?
Sure, go ahead.
Procopius says this: pestilence swept through the Roman Empire, wiping out most of the farming communities and leaving a trail of death and desolation. At Constantinople, they dug pits all around the city and laid the dead there. But later on, those making these pits, no longer able to keep up, mounted the city walls and filled practically all the towers with corpses. As a result of this, an evil stench pervaded the city, especially whenever the wind blew fresh from that quarter. And if, for those of you who know the size of the Theodosian walls and have ever seen them in person or seen photos of them and seen how large the towers are and know that there's nearly 100 of them.
It's quite a disturbing thought.
It's a disturbing thought, you know, and not to venture there because, you know, we obviously, we live in a present situation, let me just leave it there, where terms are thrown about. The bubonic plague of Justinian is literally a plague. It is a pandemic of arguably the worst kind and probably the most thoroughly reported one up until the Black Death of the 1300s.
Indeed, in terms of the...
Be no quantifying the damage this does to the Mediterranean. Like Apostolic said earlier, it basically destroys anywhere from a quarter to a third of the population and robs the empire itself of approximately half of available manpower. It's a calamity.
And this again, you know, affects on your point, Colombo, which is the urban nature of Italy. Yes, it certainly was more urbanized relative to the other provinces, but nevertheless, there was this post-plague devastation and post-war devastation.
Yeah. But I mean, because that population had to be sustained, right? And it was sustained throughout the entire imperial period by importations of grain from Africa, particularly Egypt. And this was all gone now, and so the population was already really struggling with famine, and then war, and then the plague. So it's just
to give a bit of context, Egypt and Africa will be lost in the course of the 7th century, both to the Umayyad Caliphate. And Constantinople would still maintain a huge respectable size during this point, but Rome basically became like a provincial town by comparison. You know, all of these cities were in massive decline. But this had been a process happening even before the plague.
For those who don't know, Rome sort of before the, let's just say, the barbarians take over Italy, Rome still has, certainly up until the Constantinian period, still has a population of around 1 million. By the time of the arrival of Belisarius at the head of the East Roman army, Rome approximately is around 500,000-600,000, which is approximately the size of Constantinople, so they're of a relative size. 150 years later, Rome barely has a population in the tens of thousands. It might be 20 or 30,000. So this is a monumental demographic collapse of population that we cannot even comprehend.
Yeah, one likes to imagine the the size of Rome, all of the grand buildings, the forums, the arcades, all empty, really, ruined habitations. And it makes you think, and then you read some of the poetry that came at this time, and they speak about the works of giants and people huddling in these buildings, and it's very poignant. It's so grand that it's downfall.
And in an ironic sense, sort of post 1204, sort of Constantinople sadly suffers a similar fate, but that's another conversation for another day.
I was going to make the same point, but keep on topic. Now, getting back to the religious controversies that you brought up earlier, Colombo, we'll finally get to them now. In 713, after a period known as the 20 Years' Anarchy in the Byzantine Empire, or Eastern Roman Empire, you have the ascension of one Leo III the Isaurian. And he would lead a top-down iconoclastic revolution within the church. And by iconoclasm, of course, it is the destruction of images, which was supposedly venerated and seen as idol worship, golden calf worship, venerating the image and not venerating the meaning behind the image. And there's theory as to why this happened. On one hand, it's about this moral rejuvenation of the Eastern Roman Empire. Many people sort of believe it was inspired by the iconoclasm of the Umayyads, who had recently just conquered vast possessions of the
Is there not a possibility that they were motivated by the same thing that motivated the Protestants? That is money.
Yes, and there is an argument about wealth, and this is an argument which gets in particularly about the papacy, which is about wealth redistribution and why the papacy was in a position to abandon the Eastern Romans. The effect is that the Pope, the Byzantine popes had been relatively loyal considering their position. There had still been a episcopal council, where all of the patriarchs were there, had their approval by the emperor, and they approved of the emperor, in terms of legitimating this idea of one Christian sovereign in the form of the emperor. However, as a result of the and this is the Pentarchy, with the reign of Leo the Third, all of this begins to break down. You have a series of popes who are still quite compliant, such as Pope Zachary, who was the last Byzantine pope. Nevertheless, the popes do oppose the encroachments of iconoclasm, and the people of Rome, also the people of the Exarchate, also oppose the iconoclastic fervor as well. And so in 727, Ravenna itself revolts against the Byzantine authority. It doesn't get taken over by the Lombards just yet. The city itself revolts. It's the population who are revolting against the iconoclastic measures being placed on them by above. To make matters worse, in 732, Leo would begin confiscating various papal patrimonies in southern Italy and Sicily, which were, you know, great sources of the papal income at this point. And income is always a pervasive point to deal with papal history. Emperor also removed various bishoprics from the influence, and by influence I mean, you know, where the Pope has a controlling say over the appointments of certain bishops all across the Eastern Roman Empire. So, you know, great cities such as Thessalonica. As a result of this, the popes in Italy, despite, you know, still being loyal to the Eastern Roman Emperor, became pigeonholed effectively, where they'd lost their influence within the empire. They've had this, you know, iconoclastic revolution that had been placed upon them, you know, regardless of their theological objections to it. And now they're being stripped of most of their income at the same time. And so you see, and again, you also have the collapse of imperial authority as well. The Lombards, just before the end of the Lombard kingdom, go through this brief moment of rejuvenation. First, it happens under Liutprand, who begins to consolidate the duchies of Spoleto and Benevento under his leadership again. And in response, both the dukes of Spoleto and Benevento seek amnesty in Rome under Gregory III. And in response, Liutprand besieges Rome. Who does Gregory III, you know, look to for support? It's not Leo III the Isaurian. It's Charles Martel, who is now the majordomo of the Magovian Empire, would later become the Carolingian Empire. So already you see this early relationship between the Franks. And I think what's also important to mention is that the Franks, contrary to the Ostrogoths and the Lombards, had from the very early point been Orthodox Chalcedonian Christians, you know, fanatically so, much more so. So there was a natural alliance in that. And appealing,
I mean, from the conversion of Clovis onwards, right?
Yes, exactly. So moving on from this, in terms of this relationship, in 752, Pope Zachary dies, and he's considered to be the last of the Byzantine popes. And you have the election of Pope Stephen II. To complement this, a year before, the new Lombard king, Aistulf, had destroyed the Exarchate of Ravenna, you know, all of the last vestiges of Byzantine authority in the north. Even as we mentioned, Byzantine authority in the south would, you know, persist for hundreds of years beyond this point. And in order to save himself, his own temporal position, Stephen II, he invites Pippin III, who has just replace the Magovians and establish the Carolingian Empire, into Italy to spare his domains. Now the Pope, in the absence of the Emperor, claims that he is the holder of the possessions of the Exarchate of Ravenna. And this will get into my next map, talking about how significant this is in terms of the donations of territory, which would, again, impact on Italian politics, you know, all the way until the end of the fragmentation period, until the creation of a Italian state in 870.
And again, we see the overlordship, right? It's kind of the situation with Theodoric, but flipped, if you will.
Yes, the Pope relying this time on the Carolingians. And again, for Pippin III, this works as well. Not only does Pippin get a pretext to expand his domain into Italy at the expense of the Lombards, who are, as we mentioned, consolidating, but also he gets an opportunity to legitimate his regime by having papal sanctification for it, even though this is moving on to our next conversation regarding the Franks. So I really don't want to get too much into it. Needless to say that Aistulf is defeated by Pippin III. And I believe the last king, it's not like a firm conquest. You know, Pippin III enters into Italy and then he leaves. And the Lombards quickly regroup under the final king, Desiderius. And it is the conquest of Charlemagne in 774, which puts an end to the reign of Desiderius, you know, definitively. And that is the end of the localized kingdom of the Lombards in the north, even though in the south, Benevento would continue for a long time.
And he takes the title of the King of the Lombards,
and that will be the basis for the Kingdom of Italy, which will become amalgamated with the Holy Roman Empire at the same time. But the significance about this is that, as we saw, the Lombard kings were willing to try and take over almost by force the actual temporal holdings of the papacy. And one of the very significant things that both Pippin the Short, Pippin III, and Charlemagne do is they legitimate this idea that the former possessions of the Exarchate are the temporal possessions of the popes, even though beforehand they had been the possessions of the Eastern Roman Emperor, now the hated line of the Isaurians. And they do this through the what's now basically considered to be the forged documents of the Donations of Constantine, which vests the Pope with temporal authority as well as spiritual authority.
And as such, you sort of see the genesis of this contention that begins to brew between East and West, by between Constantinople and Rome, which, I mean, this we'll obviously talk about a bit later, but culminates in the schism of, I think it's 1054, and quite tragically with the sack of the Constantinople in the Fourth Crusade of 1204. Like these tensions begin here, almost at this point.
Well, to my mind, the 8th century is the definitive turning point, because before you had episcopal unity with the Pentarchy, but Leo III, with his iconoclastic revolution and with his stripping of much of the revenue and much of the authority of the Pope to appoint certain bishoprics within the Eastern Roman Empire, leaves the Pope essentially in the position where he has to rely on another source of authority, and that being the Carolingians. And also it relegates his realm to this temporal domain in Italy. And all of these things, as far as I'm concerned, you know, set the papacy down the path of definitive schism with the East, if not theologically, then very much politically. And you mentioned the schism between the papacy and the East. I think this is also portentous of the schism between the papacy and the Western empires at the same time, because in order to legitimate the Carolingian Empire, both Pippin and Charlemagne confirm the temporal possessions of the Pope, and in so doing they make the Pope a source of independent legitimacy outside of the temporal realm of the Carolingians themselves. And this will have, in terms of looking at this in terms of an overarching Italian history, this will have major effects in terms of what we'll get to, the Guelf and the Ghibelline conflicts between
the creation of Christendom in general, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So as you can see, there's a reason why we covered all of this, because all of these...
Could I elements... ask one question?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Sorry, this isn't... I'm not an expert in this area, but the territory of the papal states at this time, I assume it's the sort of classic formation of, you know, sort of the north half, if you will, of Italy. Yeah. So it's interesting. So we see the papal state exactly conform with the
the Byzantine, with the Exarchate of Ravenna.
So we could argue that that using the Donation of Constantine, they are also drawing on Romanitas. Right?
Exactly. They're using a Roman source of legitimation for their own temporal power. And as you can see, this is in 1815. And this this is from the Congress of Vienna. And this state of affairs would exist all the way up until 1859. So from 774 all the way until 1859, the popes claim virtually the same authority with a few minor alterations, such as Ferrara or Bologna, you know, flipping sides, or Spoleto, flipping sides. But this general link between...
Or Avignon.
Yes, but that sort of throws away my assessment here. But this line of Rome to Ravenna via the region of Perugia, this has major enduring effects for the creation of an Italian history moving onwards. So I think that's probably a good place to leave it, because, you know, going too much into the Carolingians, of course, Charlemagne will be created emperor by the Pope. And again, you know, a constant strain of popes legitimating the Carolingian conquest and ennobling them, but also the Carolingians and later the Holy Roman Emperors being dependent on the Pope for legitimation and authority. It's incredibly important for the formation of Italy, but also for the overarching structure of Christendom as well.
I mean, through the Pope comes the Roman Imperium, if you will.
Yes, and you can argue this all is the result of the pig-headed actions of Leo III, the Isaurian.
it's an argument, yeah.
Yes. Actually, funnily enough, with this map here, just for interest's sake, if I may indulge, what you have here in some ways is the beginning, the origin of the formation of Italy and its respective regions or provinces. The northeastern part, sort of what was the area around Ravenna of the original Exarchate, becomes in the modern day the Italian province of Marche, or it translates to March. And if you read about the Duchy of Pentapolis, which is essentially the Duchy of Ten Cities, Pentapolis being a Latinization of the Greek term, it is essentially the sort of military bulwark that for their temporal realm, the papacy establishes to sort of protect Rome from the north, because several Holy Roman emperors, notably Frederick Barbarossa, attempt to sort of establish their own pope or to conquer the papal territories outright, or, you know, to dominate the area, but it doesn't quite ever work out for them. But it becomes a real battleground in the high Middle Ages.
Indeed. And again, just obviously the map will change, but I'm very much sort of focusing on the papal states in particular. Even sort of going on here in terms of the Pope having to deal with a imperial authority, of course, in this case, the imperial authority still comes from Austria. Austria exerting a hegemonic influence over Italy right until the end, but this is, you know, much later down the line. But just suffice to say that all of these trends have been set in this area of history, which we've now delineated. Now, before I go on to, asking you to shill various things which are coming up for you, do you have any final remarks on this period?
No, I think we've covered it pretty adequately, I'd say.
Marcus?
Again, I probably agree with Columba there about having covered it pretty, but I don't really have anything else to say. Sorry. Yeah, I think we're largely done. Yes. There's a few questions in the chat which probably might be worth addressing, but I'll leave that up to you if we want to canvas them or not. So,
do we have any...
I think you're being correct in your pronunciation of
Putin. Oh, Mervingian. sorry, I must be spelling it wrong. Mervingian. Okay, not... No, I've got the G in the wrong place. Thank you, Judge Caligula Bushman.
The shame. How will you ever recover?
probably not. So we have no super chat. So I'll let you get an. I'll let you shill if that's all right.
Marcus, so after you.
Oh, okay. Well, again, you know, I don't have anything to shill, so I don't have a channel. But AM has always graciously shared my Twitter handle. So if you like little snippets of thoughts, or you get a history or the occasional opinion on politics, feel free to follow. Always open for conversations, whatever. So yeah, just follow along and contribute where you want to. And hopefully if I've been adequate here, I'm happy to keep coming back, and if not, all good. Thank you.
Don't worry, you'd be more than adequate, Marcus. Anyway,
yes,
Columba.
Your military history is far better than mine, my friend, far better. In terms of shilling, I have nothing. We have our Heterodox episode coming up on Homer.
Oh, yes, yes. I'll explain this. We, of course, this is part of the Nations of Charlemagne series, the last three episodes we've done on this channel, including this episode. To prevent, you know, this channel becoming a little too monotonous, focusing on one era in history, we will be basically dividing the streams into three episodes on one series and then three episodes on the next series. So we'll be returning to Nations of Charlemagne with an episode on Charlemagne in 4 weeks' time. But in the meantime, we'll be starting our Orthodoxy, Autocracy, and Nationality series, and that'll be kicking off next Monday, getting into a deep dive regarding the ancient Greeks. So,
which I'm looking forward to immeasurably.
So the ancient Greeks, sort of referring, you know, all the way up until the Romanization conquest, so all the way up until probably Pyrrhus, we'll get to Pyrrhus of Epirus, and that'll probably be a good place to start. Of course, Columba, you brought up the Homer stream. Of course, we organize these streams in advance, but funny enough, they tend to happily coincide chronologically sometimes.
It's providence.
So we'll be able to cover both, you know, the chronology of ancient Greek history and ancient Greek mythology in the form of Homer next Wednesday. Marcus, I've seen something in the private chat. Do you want to bring up?
Yeah, sure. Sorry. No, just that I know there's no super chats, but there's actually an important question here I did see, and I did want to actually address it. I just forgot it as I was scrolling. Zachary mentioned something about, did the Lombards leave any history? And it's just too obvious a question to leave. You can see on the map here, Zachary, that there's a kingdom of Lombardo Venetia up in the north. There's actually a province around Milan called Lombardy. It remains the case today. And if you are familiar with Italians, there's usually a sort of a bit of an animosity between the Latin center, the Germanic north, and the Greco-Arabic south to some degree, and it's sort of like joke between Italians.
No, definitely, because the Papal States, right, we've talked about the Papal States in the south, because of obviously the exposed nature of a lot of southern Italy, you have the Arabs coming in, you have naval invasions and incursions, but we also mentioned that the Lombards, their strongholds were in the mountainous areas, and if you look at the map here, you can see it's in the Alps, right? It's still in the Alps, and that's their stronghold. So I hope that answers your question, Zachary.
Exactly, and I mean, in the end, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of genetics and haplogroup markings and that kind of stuff, but there has been a profound Germanic character to the north of Italy for the best part of a millennia, and that can be best expressed initially with the Ostrogothic invasion and conquest of Italy, and more profoundly with Lombard influence, and you see it to this day, and you can see it in the physiognomy of people, in sort of characteristics and mannerisms, even in language. You know, Northern Italian dialects differ from Central Italian and Southern Italian dialects. So there's plenty of Lombard influence there, even if it's not like objectively a specifically Lombard domain. It's most certainly there. So if anyone's interested in the question, yeah, I just wanted to answer that because I just thought it
was no, that's a very good point. I'll add my own little point just on top of that. Of course, you talked about the dialects, you talked about the genealogy, you talked about the culture. And again, like I said, this period is criminally misunderstood, or not even mentioned, considering how just us delineating the themes, how much of Italian history is going to flow naturally from here.
I mean, reading about this, I am amazed how neglected the period is,
exactly.
you see so many seeds being planted here,
exactly. So very much this is a fascinating area of history which is criminally undersold. But going back to the Lombards in particular, of course there's the Iron Crown of Lombardy, the Kingdom of Lombardy. And that would be the basis of a constitutional kingdom in Italy, almost you can say an ancient kingdom, unlike the modern kingdom, which was a invention of the post-French Revolution. The actual ancient kingdom of Italy, continues all the way up until the end of the Holy Roman Empire in 1806. So there is a constitutional and dynastic legacy which the Lombards leave.
With the Iron Crown of Lombardy, not only the metaphorical crown or the metaphysical crown, but the physical crown.
Oh yes, still exists,
I believe.
Yes, and Napoleon, when he was reinvigorating his Napoleonic Kingdom of Italy, which again obviously christened the French Revolution, very much styled himself as a restorer of the ancient Kingdom of Lombardy. In the same way that he would revive the Empire of the French as a restoration of the Carolingian Empire. So all of these historical allusions are ever present down in Italian history.
It's a bit rich to claim to be the new Charlemagne whilst destroying the Holy Roman Empire.
And claiming to be the king of the Lombards as well.
I mean, he had clear balls, you gotta give him that.
and also to think too that Napoleon vanquished the Knights of St. John in Malta and he destroyed the Venetian Republic in the meantime.
He's the great destroyer of all this incredible cultural heritage and this continuity of all this. As we mentioned, Venice will be established during this point and it will become an independent republic at the tail end, just after the Exarchate of Ravenna falls. I think it's in 797, but Venice starts off as a Eastern Roman outpost, very important to note. But anyway, ending this this podcast before we catalogue the entirety of the rest of Italian history.
No, come on, let's do it.
90 hours.
If you liked this content, please do like and leave a comment and do share. I keep forgetting it, but I do have a Subscribestar account, which is in the description below. So if you really like this content, consider donating via Subscribestar. Thank you both very much for this wonderful conversation, and thank you everyone for listening, and good night.
Bye bye.
Cheers everyone.